The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, so get ready to make your phone calls. Our guest today is Richard Falk, the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University, who's currently a visiting professor of Global and International Studies at UC Santa Barbara. Falk is the author of numerous books, including the brand new book, which he has co-authored with Howard Friel, Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. This is a book which covers Iraq, the Iraq War, and also historically discusses Vietnam, Nicaragua, and more recently the Venezuelan coup attempt against Hugo Chavez. And it covers a rigorous critique of the New York Times coverage. So let me welcome Richard Falk to Media Matters.
Thank you very much for having me, Bob.
It's my pleasure, Professor Falk. The book deals a lot with the issue of international law. You are an expert in international law. And maybe just for listeners who might not be familiar that much with international law, explain a little bit about what that means and why that sort of is a guiding theme through your analysis.
Well, I think that our basic position is that it's very important to bring into the debate on controversial foreign policy initiatives a perspective that takes seriously the restraints on states that have been agreed upon in various treaties, including the UN Charter, and limit the discretion of a government to use force to solve its international problems. And our contention is that the New York Times systematically excludes critical commentary on the international law aspects of contested foreign policy, while including, to a considerable degree, favorable commentary as to the international law justifications for such foreign policy. So it's not a matter of saying that they exclude international law. It's that they exclude criticism from a perspective of international law, and that, in our judgment, is a major deficiency because it deprives the American citizens of the kind of full consideration that foreign policy, particularly involving recourse to war, should entail in the early 21st century.
Well, and as I understand it from looking at the book, it's not a matter of the New York Times just sort of making some accidents and haphazardly screwing up, but there's a systematic pattern for how they do misinterpret international law. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. It's as I say, it's not quite so much a misinterpretation as a one-sided presentation. Mm-hmm. What they do is they present the apologetic arguments that support U.S. government policy, and by downplaying or actually excluding critical arguments, they distort the debate.
And before we talk about the New York Times, and I want to talk certainly about its coverage of the Iraq War, the buildup and what's going on there, first I want to clarify something. Is the New York Times, in your view, the worst of our news media for covering international affairs? I mean, why did you pick the New York Times, and how do they stand in comparison to our other news media?
No, quite the contrary. We picked them because they both have the stature and the somewhat credible claim of being the most trustworthy newspaper that presents balanced and objective views on these foreign policy issues. And because it has that reputation, most people who read it, and those include lots of the people making decisions or influencing decisions, tend to accept its presentation of these issues as the last word, the final word. And if anything, it has an image of being critical of the government, so that and of being sort of aligned with liberal points of view. So our criticism is based on the fact that the media generally is biased but even that portion of the media that's perceived as objective is itself biased in a way that is destructive of the kind of foreign policy that we believe the United States should be pursuing in the world today.
We're talking to Richard Falk today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Richard Falk is the Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton and the co-author with Howard Friel of a brand new book, The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy, published by Verso. It just came out in the past few months. I have the privilege of holding it in my hand right now. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment for Richard Falk, the number here, 333-9455, and our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. In the book, as I said in the introduction, you discuss a number of historical episodes in the New York Times coverage going back to the 1960s in Vietnam. But much of the book deals with the Iraq War and concentrates on the Iraq War. What is the core international law issues with regard to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and how are they reported by the New York Times?
Well, the core issue from our perspective is the legal and moral commitment of sovereign states not to use force except in self-defense unless they receive authorization from the U.N. Security Council. And if you don't have that authorization, and it's not a case of self-defense, then it constitutes aggressive war. And aggressive war is something that the United States took the lead after World War II in establishing as not only illegal, but as a crime against the peace. And the surviving German and Japanese leaders after World War II were prosecuted as war criminals because of their recourse to aggressive war. So it's that principle which we feel is not only rooted in law, but also rooted in practical wisdom in the way in which conflict should be handled in the world today. The two biggest disasters the United States has had in its foreign policy have been the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, and both of those would have been avoided if the discipline of international law had been accepted by our leaders. And our argument is that that acceptance was more difficult to achieve because the media and the high-end media, the New York Times, failed to bring these issues into the public debate.
Well, there have been a number of reasons given by the United States government to justify the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, some before the invasion and occupation, others sort of brought out later when the first few explanations didn't really last very long. Probably the most important one, at least in the mind of the U.S. public and perhaps the New York Times, is the notion that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government possessed weapons of mass destruction that were, you know, a dire threat to the people of the United States. Was that a legitimate claim, one, I guess, and we know the answer to some extent, or was it a legitimate concern at the time? And two, is that a significant enough reason for the United States to invade Iraq?
Well, you have to separate the political project associated with trying to achieve regime change and control in Iraq from whether there was a legal foundation for that for the invasion. And most of the world, both the world public opinion and the representatives of leading governments within the framework of the UN, don't accept the argument that was being made that the presence or the suspicion that Iraq possessed some weapons of nuclear, weapons of mass destruction was sufficient grounds to justify an invasion or a claim of self-defense. And without that justification, by standard understanding of international law, this was an illegal claim. And the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, has recently said in a BBC interview that he believed the invasion was illegal under the UN Charter, which is a treaty that binds all governments that are members of the UN.
I'm just curious, this occurred to me, if in fact one held to the principle that a nation possessing weapons of mass destruction was thereby eligible to be overthrown by another nation state, how many countries other than Iraq would have been, you know, candidates for an invasion by that principle?
Well, if you take the principle as you stated it, the United States would be at the head of the list.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in other words, it's to begin with, the idea that some countries can have these weapons and others face invasion if they obtain them for the sake of their security as they see it, of course, it would create chaos in the world. And that's one of the reasons that many governments, even if they believed that there were weapons of mass destruction, felt that the Iraq invasion would be a terrible precedent.
So even if the Iraq did have weapons of mass destruction, it was not a legitimate grounds for an invasion by international law?
Yes, that's I think, the most widely held view. And our position in the book is not that you need necessarily to accept this argument that I believe is persuasive and is persuasive for most of the world, but that the readers of the New York Times and other serious newspapers should have been given both sides of the argument. We're not saying they should exclude the administration's arguments and facts and so on, but that this is such an important decision for a democratic society to make that both sides of the international law argument should be available to the readers of a newspaper like the New York Times.
And how did, especially in the period leading up to the U.S. invasion in 2003, how did the New York Times cover the international law implications of the invasion concerning weapons of mass destruction and the very notion of whether or not Iraq had these weapons of mass destruction?
They tended to quote those few international law experts who supported the invasion and gave them op-ed space on their editorial page. They also coupled that with very irresponsible reporting on the nature of the Iraqi threat, which they themselves, subsequent to the invasion, have more or less apologized for, with sort of unprecedented kind of thing that they admitted that they didn't pursue adequately journalistic practice in checking the sources that they were relying on. They were relying heavily on Ahmed Chalabi and other exile voices that were trying to build a case for intervention because they wanted to overthrow the regime in Baghdad.
We're talking to Richard Falk today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Richard Falk is the co-author of the new book, The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy, with Howard Friel. We're discussing that book today. It covers how the New York Times assesses issues of international law and U.S. foreign policy, in particular looking at the Iraq War, but also historically going back to Vietnam and Nicaragua and some other issues. We hope to talk about all of them. If you wish to call in, we do have a couple lines open, and I'm about to turn to callers. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let me also remind listeners that next week on Media Matters, we will have a special two-hour version. We're going to bump the hour ahead of us and go from noon to 2 Central Time here in Champaign-Urbana. It is, of course, my favorite weekend of the year, Pledge Drive weekend, and my good friend John Nichols from The Nation will be joining us for 2 hours. Plus, we're going to have a bunch of call-in guests, and we're going to have a terrific time. So please call in and have your credit cards by your side when you do. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Richard Falk.
Hey, this is interesting. I'm wondering if Dr. Falk would maybe say something about how the New York Times is reporting the current election in Iraq. I read an editorial this morning by foreign correspondent to the Toronto Sun, Eric Margolis, who writes very succinctly. He says, no election held under a foreign military occupation resulting from an unjustified war is legal under international law. During the Cold War, elections staged by the Soviets after invading Afghanistan, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia were rightly denounced by the U.S. as frauds and the leaders elected as stooges. I wonder if he would comment. And I just would throw in something else, maybe said that John L. Hess passed away.
Okay. Well, thank you very much,
thank
caller.
You.
And as you answer that, I guess there's really two components, the international legal status of these elections, and then also perhaps the coverage of the U.S. news media, particularly the New York Times. I know that's not part of the book. It's more recent, but if you some sense of that.
Yes, I am grateful to the caller. It was an intelligent question and comment, and I essentially agree with the implications of what he was saying, that elections under this kind of foreign occupation are, if not strictly illegal, clearly politically suspect and without a great deal of weight in legitimizing the outcome. And one can only imagine how one would feel about an election in this country if we had the equivalent, given our population and size, of the 150,000 American troops that are in the election process there in Iraq. It just doesn't have the sense of the kind of process that expresses the will of a citizenry and therefore corresponds to upholding the right of the Iraqi people to determine their own future.
Professor Falk, before you go on, let me clarify this so I'm clear. Now, are you saying that the current elections in Iraq do indeed violate international law, or are you saying they're in the gray area and they look a little murky?
Yes, I think that I would put it in that gray area. There's no clear prohibition, but as the caller suggested, these conditions don't give rise to the perception of legitimacy, and therefore they seem to be violating the obligations of the occupying power not to interfere with the right of self-determination of the society that is occupied.
Do you have an assessment of how the New York Times has covered these elections, or the balance of the U.S. news media, for that matter?
Yeah, well, I think they have not raised this issue sufficiently clearly. Again, I think with the as with the earlier questions, even though I think that the grounds for a legitimate election don't exist, both for security reasons and for the legal reasons associated with foreign occupation, there is an argument that this is a way of achieving normalcy in Iraq and that it is an appropriate initiative. What I'm suggesting is that sense of balance about the issue is not being reported in this country by the media, including the best of the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. And if you read the overseas media, including, as the caller suggested, what is being written in Canada and in the United Kingdom, in Europe, it emphasizes this issue. And so, therefore, we in America receive a distorted view of a question that bears very centrally on our presence in Iraq and on the costs of that presence, which include, of course, casualties on both sides that are likely to persist indefinitely.
Last month, the Bush administration formally announced that it acknowledges there were no and are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that reason for the war clearly was not something that justified an invasion. Another argument that was given before the invasion was the connection between Iraq and the global terror network, Al-Qaeda, and the people who were responsible for 9/11. I think there, again, legal questions aside, the factual basis of that has pretty much been undermined, and that argument's not made as much anymore. The argument that the Bush administration now uses to justify the invasion and occupation primarily is that Saddam Hussein was a really bad guy, and that everyone in the world, especially Iraqis, is much happier with a democratic government in Iraq, in the middle of that region. And what is there a legal basis for invading a country because the government in that country is lousy and everyone will be happier if you can have a democratic government?
Well, there's some legal basis with a Security Council authorization for invading a country that is engaged in genocide or ethnic cleansing. The Kosovo War of 1999 could be viewed as an example of that, even though there was, at that time, no Security Council authorization, but there was a humanitarian emergency. The problem with that argument, from a legal point of view and from a moral point of view in relation to Iraq, is that the worst excesses of the Saddam Hussein regime were a decade earlier, and at that time the United States not only didn't do anything about it, it more or less embraced that regime as a strategic ally in the context of the Cold War. So very few people around the world accept the authenticity of the argument that this was a humanitarian intervention. Even if they accepted that authenticity, there is a consensus that countries cannot unilaterally embark on this effort to liberate societies from oppressive governments. The costs are too high, the precedent is too bad, and there are many oppressive governments around the world, and to do something about those needs to be left, given the way the world is structured, to those societies to correct their own situation through internal struggle. And the exception to that, which I think had been emerging in the 1990s, was if there's a situation of imminent genocide, then there is a case for humanitarian intervention with the mandate coming from the UN so that it will not be a unilateral initiative. And we see that, for instance, in the Sudan at the present time, there isn't the political will, either within the UN or outside of it, to take the sort of effective action that would be required in what is a genuine humanitarian emergency.
We're talking to Richard Falk today in Media Matters. He's the co-author with Howard Friel of The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy, and he's the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. We have many people on the phone lines who have been patiently waiting. I'm going to go to you right now. Let me remind you the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Line 1, Chicago, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Richard Falk.
Good afternoon. Thank you for a good program. I happened this weekend to have read in the February issue of Z Magazine both the review of your book and Professor Falk and the essay by Noam Chomsky called The Imperial Presidency. Both essays, and I'll be interested to see how widely reviewed your book is when you take on a paper as revered as the New York Times. Both essays seem to make the point that the media act as cheerleaders for the ruling power elite and tend to ignore the public interest in that in achieving that balance you were talking about. Chomsky cites a number of polls that say that the public, if they're consulted, back the use of the UN in resolving international disputes, back the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. There's a case cited in the review of your book about the judgment against the U.S. in Nicaragua in 1986. I think it mistakenly says for illegally arming the Contras. I think it was for mining the harbors, and the U.S. was fined $17 billion, which it simply turned its back on and refused to pay. Do you think that it would be also useful in the future to take on the direct issue, does the U.S. public believe that the United States is above the law?
Yes, that's a very well-expressed comment, I think. And I do think that's a crucial question that should be posed more or less as you suggest, because I think the kind of world we're living in is one in which all countries, strong or weak, need to accept the discipline of international law. And we need a media that encourages that point of view, or at least is open to that point of view. And as I've suggested, it isn't something that would even hurt the American position in the world. It would, in my view, help it, because it would be a way of restraining those elements in our policymaking community that engage in irresponsible and aggressive behavior that tends to be self-destructive, as both Vietnam and Iraq have, I think, demonstrated. There's an illusion that because we have military superiority in relation to these various adversaries around the world, that we can translate that successfully into good political outcomes. But Vietnam and now Iraq should have taught us that the legal restraint is a better guide to policy than is the reliance on military superiority.
I think the logical question, Richard Falk, that jumps out as we hear you speak and as we read your book is, you know, why does the U.S. news media fail to report international law accurately? Why does it fail to report it at all in some cases? And why, especially, does the New York Times, the leading news medium in the United States, do so? I mean, what's your explanation for why we see these patterns?
Well, I think the fundamental explanation is the sense that the credibility of the New York Times depends on it not challenging crucial initiatives of the government. That, in other words, there is built into its sense of media responsibility a subservience to government policy rather than what they claim to have, which is an objective posture in relation to that policy. And again, I would stress, it's not that they are unwilling to report international law. They are quite willing to report it when it supports U.S. government policy. If you think back to the Iran hostage crisis during the 1980s, at the end of the 1970s and early 1980s, the New York Times dwelled on the illegality of what Iraq was doing when it seized the American embassy in Tehran and held the occupants of the embassy captive for months. As much as I believe 18 months, they built the whole argument around the immunity that embassies enjoy and the violation of a basic principle of international law. I think it's very important to understand that they're quite prepared to give space and attention to international law, but in a one-sided way. And what I think would be important is the two things. One is to open the debate so that you get a balanced view of the relevance of international law. But secondly, as your caller suggested, to raise the whole fundamental question as to whether American foreign policy should or should not accept the discipline of international law as a limiting condition.
We're talking to Richard Falk, author of the new book, The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy, today on Media Matters, coming to you live on WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Richard Falk.
Yes, I'm very excited to talk to you, sir, and I'm very interested in reading your book. Just a couple of questions. I'll just say both of them now. One is regarding whether you think there's been an increasing one-sidedness of the Times. I've noticed in the Week in Review column on Sundays that it tends to be increasingly, well, not necessarily in every case conservative, but I'm not impressed. I'm increasingly unimpressed with the kind of coverage they're having in the paper regarding a variety of issues. The second thing, more importantly, with regard to these elections again, what I'm interested in is whether you think that, at least potentially, that one might interpret these elections as, in Iraq that is, as a perfectly orchestrated propaganda mechanism for post-facto legitimation for the invasion. And what I mean by that is, I've been listening to NPR and watching PBS and so on, and in almost every case, they will have someone like Walter Russell Mead or Fuad Ajami, who tend to function, it would seem, as apologists for this in claiming that, you know, with the election, that is their great success. And the reporters as well will assume that because there are long lines, that means that there really are perhaps 70% of the people voting, which I find outrageous because there are almost, from what I understand, no observers in the country, international observers. And, of course, it could simply mean that in the few polling places that are there, that they do have long lines because it's so dangerous just to get out of one's house that, you know, unless one has a national poll, we won't even know what the percentages are, and we can't even, you know, we can't even prove at the end of the day, since they're no observers, that actually 70% of the people or a large percentage voted. Even aside from the issue of the Sunnis. So I'm curious what you think about that.
Yes, I tend to accept the interpretation that you intelligently provide. We don't know even whether there's pressure being exerted in various ways to get people to the polls. There's no objective level of observation there. And the skeptical questions that have been raised in the discussion in this program are just not given any attention by the media, either the mainstream radio media or TV or the best of the newspapers. So, again, we are being propagandized in order to support a very dubious military occupation that is costing many lives, American lives, and more Iraqi lives. So that I think it is a scandalous failure of the media to not allow us to understand that there's a lot of reasons to doubt the legitimizing effects of these elections.
Richard Falk, where do you go to find alternative accounts of what's taking place in Iraq and around the world politically? To put what the New York Times writes and other U.S. news media into context.
Well, I think if you read a variety of sources for and magazine sources such as The Nation or The Progressive in this country, or even the more mainstream European journals such as The Economist gives one a better grasp of these issues. Le Monde Diplomatique's English edition, I think, is a very good source of more objective, more progressive understanding of these issues. I do think it's rather sad that in order to find at least mainstream critical writing of the sort that I'm talking about in the daily media, one really has to look outside the U.S.
Is there a news media in another leading country, say Britain, France, Germany, where the leading newspapers basically present the view of international law and the U.S. role in the world similar to the New York Times, or is this basically a U.S. phenomenon?
I think it's basically a U.S. phenomenon, partly because, in one way, law is important in this country, and therefore its exclusion or its one-sided presentation is part of the way in which the government goes about validating its policies. I think that form of debate and justification is less central to the way in which political debate takes place in other societies, though the European countries have become increasingly committed to the idea that it is important to rely upon the UN in situations of this kind, and that it is undesirable to entrust decisions about the use of force and recourse to war to unilateral processes of decision by sovereign states.
We're talking to Richard Falk today in Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Richard Falk.
Yes, thank you. I've got a comment and two questions. The comment is that I wanted to point out that you're hardly alone with what you're proposing there. And to quote Janine Jackson, for example, FAIR, the organization FAIR, a couple of years ago, she was critiquing the media for not being able to answer the question, why do they hate us so much after 9/11 and all that? And she said she would think a minimal requirement of such a conversation to discover why they hate us so much would be for the media to point out that when some of the so-called policy options that are being put forward by government officials and pundits are violations of international law, are illegal. You know, if they just point that out, maybe they'd get someplace with figuring out why they hate us so much. My two questions have to do with the possible actions outside of the United States and within the United States. Outside of the United States having to do with universal jurisdiction, that notion, and inside the United States having to do with civil disobedience. The first question, as I understand it, the Nuremberg and the Yugoslavia war crime tribunals both recognize the notion of universal jurisdiction, where any country, a court in any country that has jurisdiction, well, you can explain it better than I can, but it has jurisdiction for human rights violations anywhere, and that, in fact, lawyers in Belgium put a case against the United States on behalf of Iraqi individuals and personally harmed by the illegal U.S. attack. I was wondering if you could talk about universal jurisdiction a bit and about what might have happened with that court case. And then my second question has to do with, as I understand it, within this country, there is in international law the idea, for example, proposed by the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal, that anyone with knowledge of illegal activity and an opportunity to do something about it is a potential, and an opportunity to do something is a potential criminal under international law unless the person takes affirmative measures to prevent the commission of the crimes, unquote. And therefore, what it's suggesting is that within this country, civil disobedience would be one way for us to react to what's going on in this country, and so that we could block a U.S. base or a military corporation, things like that. Can you tell me, does that notion, what kind of support would there be internationally for people here acting in civil disobedience to our illegal activities? So the two questions, one about...
No, I think he's got it. Thank you very much, caller.
Good. Those are hard questions, and I can...
Yeah, we're grading on a curve, though, Professor Falk. So.
I hope I'm a beneficiary of that. The universal jurisdiction issue is one of saying that courts, national courts, not international tribunals, national courts, have the legal authority to punish individuals that are brought before them for crimes of state, no matter where those crimes take place or when. And this is a controversial notion, but as the caller suggested, there is a Belgian initiative, and there's actually Spain is now prosecuting some individuals associated with the Pinochet period of dictatorship in Chile, it is moving toward the recognition that when a government engages in acute violations of human rights involving torture or involving forms of ethnic cleansing, extreme behavior of that sort, that it should be treated the way piracy was treated in earlier centuries. That is, whoever can catch the pirate has the authority to punish, because it's a crime against the community of nations, not just a crime associated with the place where it occurs. But it's a radical notion. It's been directed at Henry Kissinger. It's been directed at Ariel Sharon and other controversial leaders. I believe the Belgian law was invoked against Arafat and against Saddam Hussein. So it is one thing that's happening in the world, that national courts are taking upon themselves this authority to punish those who are alleged to have committed war crimes.
Do you think it's a good or bad thing, or in the middle?
I think in the middle, actually, because I don't think the world is quite ready for it, because there's such a uneven awareness of what constitutes a crime. On the other hand, it is a way of inhibiting certain kinds of behavior and communicating in a certain dramatic way that certain forms of behavior are unacceptable, and that they are universally unacceptable. So I think the effort to prosecute Pinochet around Europe and now in Chile itself is a positive step in imposing on leaders an obligation to observe international law and to affirm the idea that there is a law beyond the will of the state. Now, do you want me to say
Yes,
the civil disobedience arc. Actually, the way the caller posed the issue, it's really not civil disobedience. It's what's called the Nuremberg Obligation. That is, during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt urged the German people not to accept German law, but rather to act in accordance with international law and with a certain kind of fundamental moral engagement with human decency and collect evidence of the criminality of their own leaders. And this has been interpreted as saying there is certainly a right and possibly an obligation not to obey those aspects of state policy that contradict international law in the context of war and peace. And so that's a very important, I think, potential source of opposition and resistance to an illegal policy being pursued by the government. Civil disobedience is where you knowingly, for symbolic, moral, and political reasons, violate what you accept as a valid law in order to dramatize its unacceptability, and that's what was done, for instance, in the civil rights movement and parts of aspects of the Vietnam opposition, even though in Vietnam there was a combination of civil disobedience and what I'm calling the Nuremberg Obligation.
We're talking to Richard Falk today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Richard Falk is a professor emeritus at Princeton University and expert in international law, and the author with Howard Feil of the new book, The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. I want to get back to the phone lines now. We have three people waiting patiently. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with Richard Falk.
Good afternoon. The two more recent examples of both of those specifics that were asked about is Rumsfeld apparently canceling his travel plans to Munich because of the Center for Constitutional Rights case in the German court. And as far as actions locally, the in several cities around the country, at least, there have been some actions in front of recruiting stations, offices. So people are actually already doing that stuff, and it's having some kind of effect. I wanted to call in and go back to the idea of what a army of occupation is allowed to do and what you examined in your book. And sort of by way of illustration, people around here believe that the U.S. was authorized to by the U.N. I guess it's a repetition of the 12 U.N. resolutions, but I had an experience calling in on a call-in show, obviously not this station, where I just asserted that you know, there was no legal, nothing legal given by the United Nations to authorize the invasion, and several callers called in and said that was just absolutely untrue, that they had been authorized. And I think this is because of the kind of inattention that the newspaper of record gives to international law, that people don't even know this basic basic fact, basically. So what I wanted you to talk about, if I could, is whether you looked at where the obligations of an occupying army come from and what the U.S. has done in the way of, let's say, the sort of the civil aspects of having using Iraqi money to pay American contractors and that sort of thing. And I it seems to me that there's a fairly credible argument that the occupying army shouldn't be involved in setting up an election that's going to then make rules about those kind of bargains and agreements. If I'm clear, I'll hang up and I'll...
All right, you're very clear. Thank you very much. Professor Falk?
Yes. Well, first let me just clarify this issue of what the UN had done before the invasion. There were these resolutions that the United States claimed that Iraq had violated, but that claim was not accepted by the rest of the UN as building a foundation for recourse to force and the invasion. And the United States specifically tried with Secretary of State Powell making a very elaborate demonstration of the Iraqi threat to obtain that authorization, and that wasn't provided. And that's why President Bush and others got so angry at the UN, because it wouldn't endorse the invasion, and France in particular was, France and to some extent Germany were blamed for not giving support to the U.S. So I think that's that issue was clouded by the way in which the media sort of parroted the very weak rationalization that the U.S. government was trying to give for saying it was carrying out the U.N. Will rather than defying it.
If I can sort of paraphrase the balance of the caller's question, because we're sort of running low on time, you've discussed the election already. He also referred to the United States occupying forces sort of reconstituting the Iraqi economy along ways that might be favorable towards U.S. interests. Is that get into murky waters in international law?
I'm not an expert on those aspects of the law of occupation, but I have my strong impression is that that is a kind of murky area. Of course, if you recall the occupation of Germany and Japan after World War II, we certainly did do an elaborate reconstruction effort during the period of occupation, and including reestablishing a functioning democratically, or at least a constitutional form of government. And accepted. It wasn't much of a challenge posed to it. It really depends on the context. And you have the situation now in Palestine where there is an Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, yet there seems to be a sense that the elections that are being held there do reflect the views of the Palestinian people and are a constructive step in the search for some kind of peace. So we're dealing with a situation where there are no clear red lines that law provides, unlike the situation that I had been discussing earlier, where recourse to war, there are red lines, and it's those red lines that have been so flagrantly violated from time to time by the United States, and that the media has not done a very balanced job in calling to the attention of the American people.
We only have time for one last and very brief call for Professor Richard Falk, author of The Record of the Paper, who's been our guest today on Media Matters. And let me remind you, listeners, next week, a two-hour version of Media Matters, beginning at noon Central Time, going from noon to 2. John Nichols will be the guest. It's a great show. Lots of surprise people calling in. Let's go to our last caller right now. Line 3, you just have a few seconds for your call.
Any response from the Times? And if not, what can a reader of the Times do?
Any response from the Times? And if not, what?
Not yet. And I think a reader can try to make this point of view more insist, you know, put pressure on the Times by letters to the editor and other forms of clarification, could call for clarification on its view of the relevance of international law.
Have there been reviews otherwise in mainstream U.S. media of your book yet?
There have been not, I wouldn't say mainstream, there have been sort of close to mainstream places, some newspapers have reviewed.
And how, in the close to mainstream, okay, like in the suburbs of mainstream.
Yeah, the suburbs, and there have been some TV programs that have emphasized, been built around the book.
Well, you know, I've looked at the book enough and know the area well enough to know that it is a very meticulous argument you're making and factually driven. And I think it would be difficult on an evidence basis to really dispute the claims you're making. I want to thank you, Richard Falk, for being our guest today on Media Matters. Richard Falk is the author of the new book, along with Howard Friel, titled The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and I want to thank you all for listening. Remember, 167 hours from now, 166 hours from now, high noon next week, two-hour edition of Media Matters with John Nichols. We'll be talking about his new book, Against the Beast, which carries on many of the issues talked about today with Richard Falk. Please join me then. I want to thank Victor Picard for being my terrific producer. And again, Richard Falk, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-30s and north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the lower 20s and northeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of light snow, the high in the mid-30s with northeast winds around 5 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, 580 on your AM dial and on the Internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.